Many of us wish we knew, really knew, what happens after we die. The characters in Mitch Albom's latest novel have a direct line to heaven. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll talk with Albom about his most recent novel, The First Phone Call from Heaven. We'll also talk about his faith, his writing, and maybe even some sports. Then later on, we'll get a visit from one of Santa's most dedicated helpers. Dave Stouffer of Washington, Iowa, has been making Christmas wishes come true for 40 years, and he has many stories to share. Join our conversation after the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Obama is going to highlight benefits to the Affordable Care Act with remarks this afternoon at the White House. He'll be joined by some Americans the administration says have benefited from the law. His remarks come as the White House says the health care enrollment website has undergone substantial repair and can now handle thousands of consumers' applications. Colombia's president is on a visit to the U.S. NPR's Giles Snyder reports he'll also be at the White House today.
Juan Manuel Santos is on his second official trip to the United States since taking office in 2010. And when he meets with President Obama, the peace process his government is engaged in will likely be on the agenda. Santos's government has participated in peace talks with FARC rebels in Havana for just over a year. Speaking at the University of Miami yesterday, he said he thinks the conditions are there for ending Latin America's longest-running insurgency, stretching back to the 1960s. He also said the U.S. should look more to the south, proposing a new alliance to foster better ties between the U.S. and Latin America, along the lines of the one started by President Kennedy some 50 years ago. Giles Snyder, NPR News, Washington.
The Guardian newspaper of Britain is facing a backlash from lawmakers and security agencies after publishing some NSA documents leaked by Edward Snowden. Larry Miller reports the Guardian's editor has been asked to appear before Parliament.
Guardian editor Alan Rusbridger is expected to explain to the House of Commons Home Affairs Committee why the paper ran the leaked NSA documents, which allegedly jeopardized national security. The paper has already been sharply criticized by senior security officials and lawmakers, including Prime Minister David Cameron. In August, there was further pressure when Rusbridger was ordered to destroy the hard drives containing the leaked NSA files by British security officials. He says he agreed, knowing that other newspapers had the files, and that he feared further action against the paper if he didn't comply. Rusbridger says the core issue is not just the leaked NSA files, but whether press freedom in Britain is under threat. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
A federal judge is delivering his ruling on whether the city of Detroit can proceed with plans to enter bankruptcy protection. U.S. bankruptcy judge Stephen Rhodes is reading a lengthy memo from the bench. He has found that Detroit is indeed bankrupt, but must make further declarations before the city can proceed with its actions. Judge Rhodes has determined Detroit can cut the pensions of retired workers in bankruptcy. He says, however, these must be fair and equitable cuts. Critics want to block Detroit's bankruptcy, saying Detroit needs to keep its obligation to creditors, unionized workers, and retired people. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 56 points at 15,952. The Nasdaq is up a fraction at 4,045. This is NPR.
It's 10:04. I'm Dennis Reese, Iowa Public Radio News. A plan by Alliant Energy to reduce required energy efficiency goals for 2014 through 2018 has been approved by the Iowa Utilities Board. Alliant says energy efficiency programs will cost nearly $77 million in 2014 and nearly $82 million by 2018. Environmental groups say the new goals represent less than half the efficiency progress possible. Authorities say a doctor has said a medicine mix-up did not contribute to the death of an 89-year-old man at the Rehabilitation Center of Des Moines. The Des Moines Register reports Russell Reel was mistakenly given a sedative and a narcotic painkiller on Saturday evening, and he died the following morning. Police say a doctor told investigators that the doses were too low to have been fatal. A convicted murderer who is one of Canada's most wanted fugitives isn't hiding in Iowa after all. Federal prosecutors in Iowa yesterday scrapped an arrest warrant and extradition request sought by Canadian authorities searching for Susan Fife, who has been on the run since 2007. The warrant issued in October said that Fife has been seen frequenting the Catholic Worker House in Des Moines. Kevin Vandershell, spokesman for the U.S. Attorney's Office, said investigators have since determined the woman living in Des Moines is not the fugitive. Fife was convicted of second-degree murder for her role in killing a man and burning his house down in Calgary, Alberta, in 1978. It's 10:06.
Support for NPR comes from American Jewish World Service, inspired by the belief in dignity and human rights for all, at ajws.org.
Support comes from Serenity Yoga and Pilates Studio in Iowa City, offering Yoga Alliance registered teacher training beginning in January. Tuition opportunities available on registrations received by December 21st. More information online at serenityic.com.
My favorite part about being a sustaining member is the sense of pride I have in supporting something that I truly believe in. Iowa Public Radio has been there for me for more than 30 years, and I've enjoyed every year of that.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, we'll get a visit from one of Santa Claus's most dedicated helpers. Dave Stouffer of Washington, Iowa, has been helping Santa out for 40 years. But first, Mitch Albom wears a lot of hats. He's a best-selling author, journalist, screenwriter, playwright, musician, and broadcaster. His most recent novel, The First Phone Call from Heaven, has just been released, and he'll be visiting Des Moines as part of the Des Moines Public Library's AVID series. He'll be at Roosevelt High School in the auditorium on Monday, December 9th, and he is with me today. Hello, Mitch.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, of course, a lot of people are familiar with you because of your memoir, Tuesdays with Maury. And you have said in previous interviews that it was when you were visiting Maury on those Tuesdays back then that you really started to think about the afterlife, which is a subject that comes up in many of your novels. Can you tell me what happened to you then? What made you start thinking about it?
Well, to be fair, visiting with Maury started me thinking about a lot of things that prior to I hadn't thought of at all. I was really a type A, triple A personality prior to that, and I didn't think about a whole lot except my own success or accomplishments and pace. And watching somebody sort of die in front of me every week, especially someone who had meant so much to me when I was a kid, kind of stopped me in my tracks. And each week we talked about different sort of subjects in life that he's seen through the eyes of someone who really knows he's going to die. And that was kind of my first real exposure to death. And I suppose ever since then, you know, I took a sort of broad right turn away from a lot of stuff that had seemed really important to me and towards other things that did. And then, of course, when you write a book like Tuesdays with Maury, which is supposed to be a tiny little book, it wasn't supposed to be well-received or well-read or anything, but it turned into something quite different, then all the discussions that you have with people are about those topics, too. And eventually, a lot of those things became, well, where do you think Maury is now? And is he looking down? Does he know what's going on? And that informed sort of my point of view when I ended up writing the next book after that, which was 6 years later, which was The Five People You Meet in Heaven, which was my first novel. And it kind of took a view of heaven as a place where you meet five people you knew in your life, but some of whom you might not even remember. It might have been just a chance encounter that you changed them. And I'm sure some of that was because of what I went through with Maury and how he changed me and all those ideas. So I guess ever since then, that whole sort of balance of this life and what might come next has always been floating around in my head. And I don't always write about it, but I find myself every now and then returning to the theme. And this new book, First Phone Call from Heaven, is a return of sorts to it, although this all takes place on Earth. That book all took place in heaven. This one never leaves terra firma. It's all right here.
Right in Michigan, where you live.
That's right. I was happy to, you know, well, Iowa knows. You know, we have a certain Midwestern pride, And when you write and are blessed enough to have your books received on a national level, there does tend to be sort of a coastal bias to things sometimes. And, you know, that phrase, such and such as a writer living in New York, is a very common one in this business. And so I take great pride in being a writer who lives in Detroit and who can occasionally write about it. So this is about a little town in Michigan, a fictional town way up north, that one day out of the blue wakes up and the phones start ringing and it's people calling from heaven. And they're telling their loved ones that they're okay and they're telling them what it's like. Only it only happens to a handful of people and it only happens in this town, no place else on the planet. And the book follows what happens when the story leaks out and people learn of this town and how they start descending on it and they all want to be part of the miracle. And then the media gets a hold of it and it gets bigger and bigger. And meanwhile, there's one guy who actually lives in the town who's sort of a brokenhearted guy who doesn't believe in anything, let alone miracles. He lost his wife. He was imprisoned wrongly. He's raising a 7-year-old boy on his own. And the boy comes home one day with a phone from school, a toy phone, and says, "When's mommy going to call us?" And this just pushes the guy over the edge, and he decides he's going to prove this whole thing has to be a hoax. And the book sort of sets off on this romp between his efforts to prove it's a hoax and everybody else's swirling, fervent belief that this is a miracle of miracles, and it kind of culminates with a planned for broadcast of the first actual live from heaven phone call to be heard by the whole earth at the same time, just as it seems he's sort of cracked the code. So it's a bit of a thriller wrapped around or inside of a larger message.
Could you read us just the first couple pages of the book?
The first couple pages, wow, okay. If you don't mind my making a bring sound for a telephone, unless you have a sound effect.
I do not. Okay. You can do your best.
All right, I'll do my best. This is actually then how the book begins. The week it happened. On the day the world received its first phone call from heaven, Tess Rafferty was unwrapping a box of tea bags. Ring. She ignored the ring and dug her nails into the plastic. Ring. She clawed her forefinger through the bumpy part on the side. Ring. Finally, she made a rip and peeled off the wrapping and scrunched it in her palm. She knew the phone would go to answering machine if she didn't grab it before one more ring. Hello? Too late. Ah, this thing, she mumbled. She heard the machine click on her kitchen counter as it played her outgoing message. Hi, it's Tess. Leave your name and number. I'll get back to you as soon as I can. Thanks. A small beep sounded. Tess heard static. And then, it's Mom. I need to tell you something. Tess stopped breathing. The receiver fell from her fingers. Her mother died 4 years ago. Ring. The second call was barely audible over a boisterous police station argument. A clerk had hit the lottery for $28,000, and three officers were debating what they'd do with such luck. You pay your bills, said one. That's what you don't do, said another. A boat. Pay your bills. Not me. A boat. Ring. Jack Sellers, the police chief, backed up towards his small office. If you pay your bills, you just rack up new bills, he said. The men continued arguing as he reached for the phone. Coldwater Police, Sellers speaking. Static. Then a young man's voice. Dad, it's Robbie. Suddenly, Jack couldn't hear the other men. Who the hell is this? I'm happy, Dad. Don't worry about me, okay? Jack felt his stomach tighten. He thought about the last time he'd seen his son, clean-shaven with a soldier's tight haircut, disappearing through airport security en route to his third tour of duty. His last tour of duty. It can't be you, Jack whispered.
That's Mitch Albom reading from his new novel, The First Phone Call from Heaven. And Mitch, when you were going through this process of writing the novel and imagining this scenario, where did you look for inspiration for these relationships that you would paint us pictures of through these phone calls?
Well, probably the one closest to my heart was my own mother, who right about the time when I began conceiving this book suffered several major strokes and lost the ability to speak. And she hasn't spoken since, and so it's been close to 3.5 years since I've heard her voice. And she was one of those mothers that, you know, when you were a kid, you couldn't wait for her to stop talking. So her voice was all my creativity, and everything sort of comes from her. And to have that voice suddenly silenced and yet to still have her body there, you know, I can hold her hand. I can look her in the eyes. I'm not sure she knows it's me. You know, the stroke damaged many things. But you realize that, you know, a body, a face, eyes, that's all good and comforting. But when you can't hear the voice, especially someone who your relationship was so vocal, you're really missing the guts of the connection. And I started to think about that and what would it be like to have that back. And then, you know, the whole idea of hearing from somebody after they're gone telling you, yes, it's okay. How would that change our point of view? I mean, this is the one great mystery that we can't solve. You know, we figured out everything else, it seems like, including how to deliver packages from Amazon on Sundays via drone. You know, now we've got that problem licked. So apparently there's nothing left in the world for us to solve, except what comes next. Just don't know. And if there was something that suggested, using all this modern technology, and so we're using telephones, that we could prove what came next, how would that actually change people's behavior? And as you know, if you've read the book, people do start to change. You know, they start cleaning up their act. They start behaving better. They start going to church. They stop worrying about certain things. People who have terminal illnesses aren't fighting as much as they did before. I mean, the whole concept of proof of it tends to relax people in certain ways or make people behave differently in other ways. And so, you know, once I had that idea of missing a voice and then what it would do to get it back, especially if it came from the other side, I really had everything I needed for the stew of the book, you know, all the potatoes and the meats and the vegetables, and it was just a question of, you know, portions and stirring it around.
Members of the clergy in the book respond to this miracle in different ways. Did you talk to members of the clergy and say, what would you do if somebody in your congregation came to you?
I did. That's an interesting question. The first person asked me that, they just assume I just made it all up. But I did. I went to priests, pastors, and rabbis and said, okay, so let's say this happened. How would you approach it? And you know, it was very interesting. Most of them said that they would keep it at arm's length and they would be very cautious about it. And they you know, they wouldn't go running into church and telling everybody, hey, guess what such and such had happened to them today, which was interesting because sometimes you would think, geez, anything that might suggest that there is a heaven or God or whatever, people would jump on and embrace. But the cautiousness of being sure what it is, where it is, who it comes from, I sort of used to inform the book. And as you know, it's a small town. It has five churches, which is pretty typical for a town in Michigan. If it was up north and it had maybe 2,000 people, there'd be at least five churches.
Mm-hmm.
And I make them different denominations. And as is probably the case, first they start wondering, well, why did it happen in that church and not in our church? And what does that mean about the Catholics versus the Protestants in town, or why not this synagogue, whatever? And then as it starts to happen to more of them, from a Catholic point of view, they actually investigate it as a miracle, which I looked into and saw what the process was. And they really do send somebody out from the archdiocese, and they're supposed to ask a bunch of questions. And there's kind of a protocol that they go through. And then if they think it might be a miracle, they send it on to this committee at the Vatican, and they send somebody out. And so that sort of happens in the book.
Well, and we're going to take a short break. Mitch, we'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with author Mitch Albom about his latest novel, The First Phone Call from Heaven. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in a few minutes, Santa Claus is coming to town. At least one of Santa's most dedicated helpers is coming to visit us in just a few minutes. But right now, I'm talking with Mitch Albom. He is an author. He's also a journalist, a screenwriter, a playwright, a musician, a broadcaster. And his most recent novel is called The First Phone Call from Heaven. And Mitch, just before the break, we were talking about the research that you did into what would actually happen within different churches if someone in their congregation said, I'm receiving telephone calls from heaven. And of course, a lot of people in the community, a lot of people in the churches respond in different ways. And I'm wondering, I know this book hasn't been out for very long, but in writing about this, you are writing about a message that so many of us desperately long for. Mm. We have lost people that we love. It would be so wonderful to know that they're in a good place. And also this idea that they could still watch us and love us from beyond is something that, that so many of us also would love to have evidence for. In writing about this, do people approach you as if you know something they don't?
Well, sometimes I get much too much credit for being some kind of expert on the subjects I write about when I'm really sort of writing them in search of. You know, it happened from Tuesdays with Maury when people would come up to me and say, "Maury, can I ask you a question?" And I would have to say, "No, remember, I'm the dumb one. You know, I wasn't the smart professor. I was the dumb student." But for the most part, actually, with this book, and you're right, it's only been out, you know, a couple weeks. But I've already heard from people who say that they've actually had this kind of experience, and for real via telephone. Not, I mean, some very chilling things. You know, a guy whose mother died at exactly 3:15 in the middle of the night, and he got a phone call. He was, you know, half a country away, and got a phone call from her saying, "I'm okay. I'll always be with you," and stuff like that. And he only found out later that morning that she had passed away. And I've heard a number of stories like that. So, you know, my thing is, one of the themes in First Phone Call from Heaven is about miracles and how people respond to them. And you were talking about the church, and that's one way. But it's also how other individuals respond to them. And I can't tell you how many times I've met people who have said to me, you know, "I was grieving my daughter. She died a year ago. I was in her bedroom. I was sitting on her bed. I was just crying. I was so sad. I missed her so much. And all of a sudden, a picture of the two of us fell off the counter, and it landed at my foot. And I know that was her. She was sending me a message that everything's okay, you know, and I felt so much better then." Now, if I wanted to, I could bring in 10 scientists and probably prove why physically, through the laws of science, that picture fell off the counter exactly when it did. But it wouldn't matter. To that woman, that was a miracle. And who's to say it wasn't? And so one of the lines in the book is, you know, what happens next depends on what you believe. And that's really true even at the end of the book. And I think it would be true of something like this. And even these people who come up to me and tell me they've received calls like this. If you believe a little miracle has happened to you, then it did. I mean, you're not obligated to prove it to the rest of the world or to prove it to science. It's okay to sort of hold it as your own little event. And I think that that's okay.
Well, and in the book, you have a character who is a television news reporter, and she is not very valued by the television station she works for, and so she gets assigned to this story because it's probably not going to add up to much.
Right.
But there are stories like this that do crop up, not infrequently, you know, where people have witnessed something that they believe is a miracle, whether it's an image appearing somewhere unexpected on a building, on
right.
a street, that kind of thing, and these stories do get told, and you know, as you said, there are people with scientific minds who are very quick to explain them away. And I think there's a lot of skepticism surrounding the reporting of these stories and how they're accepted. In your book, things really go crazy. I mean, people get so excited about this idea that they could actually get phone calls from heaven, and people are flocking to this community, and people are trying to sign up for cell phones based in this community just on the chance that maybe they could also get a phone call.
Right.
Was there a phenomenon in real life that you took inspiration from that kind of a response, that kind
well,
of reaction?
Well, remember that I work, most of my earlier life, and I still do some, in the world of sports. So I have seen people go insane for things that you keep shaking your head about and go, "Really? You're going to go crazy over this? You're going to gather? You're going to paint your face? You're going to holler? You're going to scream? You're going to be depressed for weeks? You're going to call radio stations over whether a pass should have been thrown or hadn't been thrown?" I work amongst 100,000 people all the time. That's not an uncommon crowd for me if you go to a Michigan football game. So I guess my background in hysteria lent itself well towards what if something that really made a difference in people's lives kept happening. The difference between the incidents that you're sort of talking about, which do happen, like Jesus's face appeared on the side of a building or Mother Mary in a statue and someone points when they come take pictures, versus regular repeated contact with people from heaven, more than one, not one quote-unquote crazy person, if you're dismissing them that way, but 5, 6, 7, 8, and people who have respectable jobs and people who didn't want to believe in and people who aren't religious zealots who suddenly keep hearing again and again with messages from their loved ones saying, tell everybody, because that's what one of the women says, and that ultimately leads to this live broadcast of a phone call. She says, tell the world. It's time for the world to know that there is heaven and there is something beyond. So I'm pretty convinced that this is exactly how we would behave if something like this happened. You know, I based it on 30 years of working in the journalism field and watching how people go crazy over certain kinds of stories. If we can turn Kim Kardashian into an ongoing news story, we most certainly could turn a town that was getting phone calls from heaven on a repeated basis into a national hysteria.
The one of those phone calls was not a happy phone call. One of those phone calls in your book was from someone to someone who he blamed for many things in his life and death.
Right.
Why did you choose to also include a phone call like that one? I mean, everything else was from a loved one, from a family member. This was from a man who the person who received the phone call did not love.
Well, probably because if I didn't, I'd be having this discussion with you or someone similar who would say, well, why didn't somebody call who wasn't so happy to be? I mean, if the door's open, why can't they make it? And I thought it flushed it out a little bit, you know, to make it seem, well, wait a minute, if there's open communication, that doesn't always have to be, I'm okay, I love you. What if there's someone trying to settle a score or get even? And as it turns out, you know, there's a reason for that call being made. I don't want to reveal it, you know, and ruin the story of the book, but it isn't just somebody calling from the other side to taunt somebody. There's a larger reason at hand. But I just thought it was more interesting if not every call echoed the same sentiments about I'm okay and I love you and I miss you. And again, it's all fictional, so it can go any which way.
Speaking of small details in fiction, you have a deadbeat dad that disappears to, of all places, Iowa. In your story.
That was no knock on Iowa. I just thought he could hide easily there.
I don't know. There aren't that many of us.
Well, that's true. Maybe I should have had him hiding in California. But no knock on Iowa. I love Iowa. It's a good state. I've been there many times.
Oh, that one just surprised me. Sorry. I'm talking with Mitch Albom, who is a best-selling author. His most recent novel is called The First Phone Call from Heaven. Of course, as you know, if you know who Mitch Albom is, and you probably do, he wears a lot of different hats as a journalist, a screenwriter, a playwright, a musician, a broadcaster, a sports guy. If you would like to talk with Mitch, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Mitch, what is it about writing novels that, I mean, with all the things that you do, and of course I mentioned all of the things that you do for a living, but you're also very active in charitable giving. You've spent time in Haiti. You have a number of different charitable organizations that you are very heavily involved in. What is it about writing novels that makes you sit down and spend the time when time is at a premium?
Well, the only gift I've ever had, I felt, if I have any at all, is telling stories. You know, you're kind to mention all these different things I do, but to me they're kind of derivatives of the same thing. I mean, being on television or radio or writing a play or writing a movie or a book, it's all, for me, is always just kind of comes back to telling stories. And so at its purest form, that's what I like to do. And I always said that it would take me a while before I could make up stories. And I didn't write any novels until I was in my 40s, even though I had been writing from my 20s. And I had been offered to do things. I said, no, I haven't seen enough of the world yet to know how to make up a story. I need to observe more. And so I really spent the first 20 years of my writing just in nonfiction and journalism. And then somewhere around my 40s, when I started with Five People You Meet in Heaven, I felt like, okay, I know what a building would look like there. I know how a person would react if something like that happened. I've met somebody like this in my life. This character reminds me of this. It suddenly became, all right, I've stored up enough chestnuts, I can get through the winter of a creation of a book. And then it really just sort of took to me. And I probably, of all the things I do outside of the charitable work, which to me is so rewarding in its own totally different way than, I mean, it's the selflessness of it is what makes it worthwhile. And that's quite different than sitting and writing a story, which is your story and, you know, you're creating it. But of all the things I do, just sitting alone in the mornings and thinking of these novels and thinking of sort of magical ways to tell a larger picture. I like using a simple form to tell a big, try to deliver a big message. And that's what I do. That's what spurs my creativity.
You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Again, you can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And you spend some time with other writers in your, in your recreational time. You play in the band The Rock Bottom Remainders,
right,
with Amy Tan and so many others in that group. Do you, obviously you make music together. You do a lot of appearances, well, maybe not a lot of appearances.
You're being very kind to call it music,
right,
by the way.
Right. But
noise is probably a better word, but.
Do you guys talk about writing when you get together?
You know, amazingly, not so much. Stephen King, Dave Barry, Amy Tan, Scott Turow, Ridley Pearson, amongst others over the years, Frank McCourt and Barbara Kingsolver and Greg Isles. And you would think that James McBride, who just won the National Book Award, and we just played a thing down in Miami. We were all together. And all we really did was just tease James about winning the National Book Award. Nobody asked him how he did it. Nobody asked him, you know, how'd you come up the characters? He's just like, oh, can you even get in the same car with us now? You just won the National Book Award. Hey, National Book Award is the same as NBA. Does that mean you can play in the NBA? I mean, like the silliest sophomoric stuff. It's very rare that we spend a lot of time talking about writing. It's been 20 years, and I can say probably the only thing that I've learned from some of these wonderful writers, many of whom, all of whom really in my mind are more talented than I am, is they talk about like starting a book and having their characters take them someplace. Like Amy Tan's told me that, and Stephen King's told me that. So I kind of get into it and let the characters take me. And I just look at them with my eyes bugged out, and I go, you must be kidding me. My characters, I live in Detroit. My characters must be union because they just look up at me and say, we don't know where we're going. You tell us where we're going. So I need to have like a beginning and end when I start a book, and they seem to just sort of dive into the pool and swim around with their characters. But other than that, that's about as much talk about writing as we do. It's mostly sort of to get away from writing and to play music that we do or spend our time on.
Frankie is on the line from Rolfe. Hi, Frankie.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question for Mitch?
Well, I was kind of wondering, since I'm not real familiar with who he is, but I've caught your conversation this morning and I'm interested in his new book, but does he write from personal experience? Like, have you ever, Mr. Mitch, experienced any phenomena of your own that you can't explain scientifically or logically or anything like that? And I asked for a main reason is because I've experienced several different types of phenomena throughout my life, and I've been kind of wanting to write a novel or write a book or a short story about it, but don't know how to go through it. So I'm just kind of curious, as when you do write, do you write from personal experience, or have you ever had a personal experience from which to write from?
Well, thank you for the call and the question. I try not to limit the novels that I write to just my own personal experience because, you know, there's so many others like yours that would strengthen it. So, and because I hear from so many readers, because after Tuesdays with Maury, a lot of people have contacted me around the world with similar kinds of stories and things like that. I did have my uncle, although it didn't happen to me, it was a family story. My uncle had died, you know, had one of those near-death experiences while he was being operated on for open-heart surgery. And he was a salty old sailor. He ended up being the inspiration for the book, The Five People You Meet in Heaven. He was a World War II vet and a real strong, you know, beefy, gruff kind of guy. And he legally died on this table. And he told me years later that he remembered his body rising out of his soul rising out of his body, looking down on the bed or the table. And then he saw all his dead relatives, he said, waiting, just sitting there waiting at the edge of the bed. And, of course, as kids, you know, you say, well, Uncle Ed, what'd you do? What'd you do? And he would say, I told them, get the hell out of here. I'm not ready for any of you yet. And apparently he scared them right back to heaven or wherever they came from. And he came back into his body and he lived another 10 to 15 years. But I always heard that story growing up, and of course, this is from a loved one now. This isn't from someone half a world away. This is someone I trust and love, and he was so adamant about it that I always believed that that's what happens. And consequently, that became sort of the basis of The Five People You Meet in Heaven, that there were people waiting for you when you get to heaven. Only in that book, you know, they weren't all your relatives. Some of them were just people you happened to affect while you were here on Earth. So I've had experiences like that, you know, through other people. I've had dreams where I've connected with people who have passed away. I have not yet gotten a phone call from the other side. But I think, you know, one of the things that I do in the book is go back to when the phone was invented. And I weave in a story of Alexander Graham Bell, which most people don't know. And I didn't know until I started researching. About how the phone was invented. And it was kind of by accident. And it was very much an act of love. He was trying to get his deaf wife to learn how to speak, and he invented this device that measured vocal vibrations through a wire that was supposed to move a stylus and make some symbols. And instead, he kind of realized, well, wait, if it goes through a wire and I can attach electricity, I can take it anywhere in the world.
Well, and Mitch, we're going to have to read more about it in your book. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
Mitch Albom is the author most recently of The First Phone Call from Heaven. He'll be in Des Moines next Monday. This is Talk of Iowa.